welcome to the Mostly AI Smart Pod. We're from the editors of AI Impact Smart Brief. I'm Susan Rush, and along with my co-hosts, Michael Domingo and Victoria Martinez, we'll be talking about AI taking on creative and the media today. We have a fascinating interview with AI expert Tim Ringel of Meet the People. First, let's get into it and talk about last week in AI.
All right. I got a couple of picks for my first two honorable mentions in last week with AI. First is contentious. It was basically a contentious week for Fable and Mythos. And as that was being bandied about by the government, representatives and a couple of people from other organizations that are competing with Anthropic, they were basically telling people, hey, Chinese government's also, got their eyes on. In fact, Susan will be talking about this later on, there are competing technologies and they are basically catching up or even overtaking us. So it behooves the U.S. government to basically keep Fable and Mythos in some way operating in the public domain. And that was a big key story. But I'll leave that to Susan to talk about later. My other honorable mention is Meta's plans to sell its excess compute capacity, which I wrote about in Thursday's AI Impact. My favorite story, though, from last week is from The Atlantic on the return of hacker houses. And that's a hat tip to Victoria Martinez, who pointed that out to me. These are basically communal living spaces where there is potential for new tech to be incubated. It's basically putting like-minded coders together who will grind away writing code toward a goal for great things, like the next great thing to talk about in AI, of course, and who's going to be the next coder billionaire. I'd say it's like the garage startups from that basically helped Apple and Microsoft become these big, giant tech companies and what came after. But if you want a modern day equivalent, how about Summer House? I don't know if you've heard that, but that's the reality show, which is basically watching young people hook up. But instead, it's a house full of programmers hooking up for startup potential rather than potential romantic hookups. Well, maybe there's that too, right? It's interesting to see how tech entrepreneurship has evolved, but really it's kind of like the same old, right? I find it funny that hackers can't help but live up to the stereotype of the hacker person. Smart, smart-ass, awkward, like a pre-adult boy who hasn't figured out Axe body spray yet, or females. Kind of like a pre-Microsoft Bill Gates. So basically, I think the writer nailed it. And that's it for me. What's on your mind from last week?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that. It's coincidentally, the other day I saw this, like, nod to old school gaming, where it was like a bunch of people with like a bunch of wires, and like how old school gamers were connected all together in a living room with wires everywhere. And I feel like we're going back to that with the old school underground hackers living together, but like in a more technologically advanced world. Well, although that's not in my realm, my honorable mention this week is with Microsoft. I feel like Microsoft is kind of, you don't really hear about them like innovating as much as you're hearing Anthropic or, ChatGPT or OpenAI. You don't see their name as much in public. But recently, they actually have decided that they are going to merge all of their Microsoft and Copilot, all the apps into one, and they're going to call it Copilot Fusion. Basically, they're going to introduce a paid tier for it that includes AI agents. And the whole point is to cut any of the unused apps that really people have. What they realized was that 4.5% of people who actually purchased Microsoft 365, only 20% of 30% of them are actually using Microsoft Copilot. So this, by putting everything together and unifying it, they are going to hopefully boost productivity and efficiency across the board for people who get the service and hopefully attract more users as well.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. I don't know, your last week in AI's, just thinking about the popularity of Love Island streaming, I can see this hacker house finding a whole underground viewing audience. That could be interesting. But my honorable mention this week is Robinhood CEO, of course, is saying that AI traders will soon match humans. I don't know. I find that a little scary, but we'll see what happens. Just going back to kind of what Domingo was talking about, this whole idea of China and their open source AI models. You know, in Western startups, they're really starting to eye this. The last week, the GLM 5.2 AI model created a lot of buzz in Silicon Valley for its coding and agent capabilities, you know, which really are said to be matching the models from OpenAI and Anthropic, but at a much lower price. So it's really attractive. You know, and the success of this 5.2 model combined with regulatory uncertainties, you know, and then of course, you know, delays in US models, you know, has really driven that international interest in Chinese alternatives. Despite data security concerns, limiting adoptions in regulated industries, the model's performance is just prompting companies worldwide to consider their dependence on American proprietary AI offerings. So this is definitely a space to watch.
All right, welcome back. Here's All Talk with NotBots, what we like to call the catch-all for everything we talk about on AI on our mind this week. This time we have an interview with Tim Ringel at Meet the People. Before we get to the interview, be sure to check out the special episode, though, of the Mostly AI Smart Pod featuring Dr. James Stanger with CompTIA. Now let's talk about episode 5 and in this interview with Tim Ringel of Meet the People. Tim's passions lie in the advertising agency, and since 2021, he's been running Meet the People LLC, an advertising platform built from $150 million plus raised from private equity. Now he's grown that to about 800 people, working for brands like Google, Moet Hennessy, IBM, and among others. In this interview, we talked all things AI in the creative and media space. Tim offered his insights on a range of topics where AI is impacting marketing, data privacy, creative processes, the disruption of AI-driven content creation, and more. We ended up cutting about 45 minutes from that conversation. So here's just a portion of that interview.
No, usually not. Usually not. I'm not. So it's very important to discuss what AI actually means. It's very popular that in boardrooms and in the stock market, people talk about sacking and slashing people because AI is going to do it better and faster. I think that's 90% bullshit, if I'm honest about it. I believe that we have reskilled some people because we had to. When you have 30 copywriters, you just don't need 30 copywriters to do the work. But we have around 850 people today. We are growing every month in terms of headcount, not reducing headcount. Yes, we need slightly different skills sometimes, of course, absolutely. But the point is that now you can grow much faster with the same people. It's not about reducing people. You can grow more with the same people or more people. Meaning, so what I try to teach my board is don't look at it as have we cut 10% of our staff just because we can. Look at it, what's the per employee revenue growth and the per employee profit growth? And if that is going up, we're doing everything right.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about, some of the stuff that's going in the technology, since that's what we're talking about, mostly AI smart pod is focused on. I want to talk about how you use technology and Meet the People. Specifically, how do you, you were talking about a little bit about sovereignty and the different differences between the US and Europe. Are there any assurances regarding the data that you're using and like the types of guardrails that you have? Talk a little bit about that.
Number one, we don't have interest in holding any clear data. Like, that's not in the interest of our company. It makes it very complicated in terms of liability, right? So that's why we ask for access to the CRM of the clients and the GA, for example, Google Analytics. This is all theirs. Like, we don't own the data. We don't own any consumer data or such. What we do is we analyze it and then we draw assumptions to execute against it. But we wouldn't know that Michael Domingo, just bought Chase credit card and now is shopping for a BMW. Like, we wouldn't know your name. We wouldn't know that stuff, right? That's always sits with the clients. What we do ask the clients is that we would like to build synthetic audiences again, because then we can do whatever we want. Once we take the clear names out and once we anonymize the data, we can play with it endlessly, right? So that's kind of an assurance where even living across multiple companies, multiple touch points from creative content, website, retail, down to media and performance marketing, that we don't actually hold any sensitive information on the customers. Also because we do a lot of pharma work and healthcare work, we just thought it's not, would be. I'm very German with that because I'm from Germany.
Yeah. So there's no real, like, you don't have any issues like accidentally exposing data or anything like that. That's
No. That's exactly the point. The worst case scenario for a company like us is that we would get hacked and some actual personal information of people got leaked. Like, that's absolutely terrible. No, we don't want any of that information.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Question I have here is, inside your own agencies, do you have a line between tasks that should be automated for efficiency and the creative human work? Since you're bringing all these teams together, where's automation and where are the humans in this thing?
You have to differentiate by trade a little bit, right? Because people misunderstand advertising is advertising. It's not all the same. So I like to differentiate between creative and media for sure. And then I like to also differentiate between creative, experiential, and media. So in the media space, machine learning and AI has been around for a long time. Machine learning has been around for 15 years, thanks to Google, and Meta has jumped back around 10 years, right? So use of technology and adoption of technology is kind of forced on anyone in the market by those platforms, no matter what. You don't really have a choice. You can opt out for a year, but eventually they're going to push you into it. It's, you know, it's hardly any choice. So there's really no hiding. So guardrails come from the platforms, right? And then guardrails also come internally from our own tools. For example, we created our own media mix modeling that is basically technically a real-time media mix model. It doesn't make sense because the statistical relevance of the data is not enough on a daily basis to media mix model. But we can basically media mix model on a weekly base, monthly base. What formerly a holding company would do every 6 months for like $500,000, we can do pretty much in real time now for nearly $0, right? So that's just the power of AI. So the guardrails here are, we are not uploading any sensitive information into any AI tools. It all has to be anonymized and then mapped back, all the beautiful things you do. So in media, we have dealt with this for 15 years. So there's, you know, this, I would say, I would be surprised if someone, pardon my French, fucks this up. on the creative side, it's slightly different because creative, we're talking about intellectual property. So the creative side is the most, probably, so creative content and production are the most exposed when it comes to the new AI wave. Content on the back of production, but production probably the most, where formerly you would say, well, I need a big studio space with 30-foot ceilings and lots of lighting and some professional cameras. You can do most of the content creation today in AI, and you don't need any of the physical infrastructure, right? So that is very disruptive. We don't have any production studios. I consciously didn't buy any agency there because I saw it coming. I knew this would happen because I had an agency years ago that would had nearly 30 studios between London and New York. So that is really, really tricky now. So you don't really want to have a production studio. We are now building production studios, physical spaces, but they are AI production studios. They operate very different. So that's the most disrupted place. And talking about guardrails, all the bets are off. I think we see a lot of content production agencies who heavily utilize AI, but they don't really understand or care about intellectual property issues. Because once you upload something in AI, who owns it? Nobody knows, right? Who actually owns it? Like, you can put an idea into AI. You can chat with ChatGPT. Is this now your idea? Is their idea? Is a shared idea? There is no precedence yet, really, in terms of what happens with that stuff. So we're going to see a lot of issues coming out of that. So very educated clients told us clearly, IBM, Google, who are our clients. IBM is the inventor of AI with Watson, if you want to talk about public public AI, right? They made very clear that we have restrictions on what we should do and could do with AI and what we can upload and not upload. So we have to adhere to those restrictions, of course. And we do that across all our clients, really. So it's all about anonymizing the data, mapping it back. But it's very difficult if you use AI to creatively ideate, right? So again, who owns the storyboard? Who owns the imagery? It's very tricky. So we tell our creative teams, guys, you need to still touch this. Like, it's not an option to do 100% AI work, because if we don't touch it, we can't sell the IP to a client, right? The IP doesn't exist because it's not intellectual property you own. So that is probably a very disrupted space right now. We are doing fine because, again, I'm deep in technology. I'm invested in OpenAI, Anthropic, XAI. So I'm not saying I know more than other people, but, you know, I wouldn't invest there if I wouldn't try to understand it.
For sure.
And on the experiential side, and what I call experiential and commerce, we see very different disruption there from AI. We don't really see humans not interacting with humans. Actually, humans want more experiences. They want to engage with brands in physical spaces again. They want to go to concerts. They want to taste a product. They want to feel the product now, right? Before they ordered on Amazon or somewhere else. So we see a big boom, actually, in experiential and commerce, even in traditional physical commerce. But the AI disruption here is very different. You have dynamic pricing all of a sudden, right? You have product tracking that is independent from the large retail stores. So, for example, when you go into Best Buy and you talk to a blue shirt, as we call them, right, a Best Buy employee, they now have a checkout device in their hands, just like Apple does it, right? And they do that for a very clear reason, because they want real-time data for their retail media business and whatnot, right? So all of these pieces, they now start talking to each other. I think it's very likely that soon when you walk into a Best Buy and they have bought your Chase credit card data, because Chase monetizes that now. Amex doesn't, but Chase does and others do, and they pride themselves with that on their shareholder calls, right? It's likely you're going to get a different price than someone else. It's going to come. Right? And that's what we call dynamic, but it's all going to come from AI. So we see disruption in all of these different aspects. But in the end, I always tell people, I know we're going to talk about people losing jobs, people have to reskill. This is not really new. We went through it in the Industrial Revolution. We went through it with the Computer Revolution, with the Internet Revolution, and now it's the AI Revolution. We always go through these phases as society. It's more accelerated. It's deeper, right? But in the end, society still goes on. Life still goes on. But you have to re-equip your tool belt. It is not an option not to learn the tools, not to understand what it does, and also think about how you can improve your own work. But I'm getting philosophical here, but it all plays into, when you talk about guardrails, those pieces are very important. And we spend quite some time trying to educate our staff, our employees, our colleagues on how the future is going to look for them and how they can learn with us how to use it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I have a question on the technology you're using. Is there some sort of danger that companies like OpenAI and even, you know, Anthropic on high level, maybe even, I don't know, there's some lower level AI companies, where are they going to they ever encroach on the platform you're building or any of the tools you're building? Or you have to, is it a matter of like, you're going to think in 5 years, you're going to have to retool it in some way? I mean, maybe not completely take over, you know, what you're doing. Like, who knows? You might even be acquired by OpenAI or one of those companies because of the technology. Real, who knows?
But, we're talking. So I think I want to make an example that everybody relates to, right? Why hasn't Apple launched their own car? The massive industry, everybody would love it, everybody would buy it, but they haven't done it. Why? Because for them, they make so much money with what they do. They like to innovate there. They don't want to be in the car business yet, right? And why? Because economy of scale is hard. And the shareholder story is not going to resonate super well with the shareholders. It's going to resonate really well with consumers, right? But it's not going to resonate well with shareholders. So people make the mistake to assume that OpenAI really wants to do everything. And Sam has made it very clear he doesn't. He's actually pulling back on stuff because he realizes the story doesn't work for shareholders. I can't IPO this company, pride myself to challenge Elon Musk on being the next trillionaire if I try to do everything. So especially with scale, right? Google could have been way more than it is today. And they did well with launching their own operating system, their own phone operating system, their own browser, their own video search engine, or bought it at least, right? So Google diversified very heavily, but still there's so many things that Google could do and they're not doing. So I'm not worried about that. The advertising industry is hard. Chat actually, Sam actually said that by 2030, the majority of ChatGPT's revenue is going to come from advertising, but not because he's doing it, because he's selling attention to consumers or to brands, consumer attention to brands. He's going to go into the same business model, and he's already started this, that Google is in and Meta is in. So it's the opposite. I see a dramatic opportunity for companies like us, because with more players, multiple AI platforms, multiple search platforms, multiple social platforms, all of a sudden, we went from a monopoly, Google and Facebook, and a duopoly, into a very fragmented landscape. And I love it, because we have to explain this landscape. When you have $10 million as a brand, where are you going to put it? And when? And against whom? Yeah. What's the audience? And with more platforms and more options, it became just more interesting. So I don't see this. Like when Zuckerberg says, you can just give me your credit card and I'm going to run all your ads, optimize it, sell your products, and, you know, that's it. And you don't need anyone else anymore. Yeah, I don't think so. I also don't have a metaverse account, I have to say. So, you know, they like those headlines very much for their shareholder story, but I just don't see it. The reality when we talk to clients is way more complicated than what the large tech companies think they are.
Yeah. All right, Tim. I think that is it for this interview. I thank you for coming along and joining us.
Of course. Pleasure. Thank you.
All right. That was just an excerpt. My full interview with Tim Ringel runs on exclusively on the YouTube channel if you want to hear more. In any event, one of the topics that he touched on was ethics, which is not in the excerpt that you heard here. I asked him to chat up someone who we might not know, actually, that we should be paying attention to. And he mentioned a person named Wendell Wallach. He's an ethicist, someone I wasn't familiar with myself. And so I did some research on him. And I discovered he's the author of this book called Moral Machines, Teaching Robots Right and Wrong. And he also did a follow-up book just recently called A Dangerous Master. I haven't read that either, but it's going to be on my reading list because it was fairly interesting. And he talks about the moral challenges of AI and robots. And in the book, he urges creators and users to address the moral and ethical complexities of rapid technological growth brought on by them. I also recently found this opinion piece that ran in the Hartford Courant at the end of June on whether democracy has a place in the world of AI. You can find those links to these books and the article in the description. I was wondering if maybe you guys had any thoughts on that.
I definitely are going to be checking out those books. You know, just thinking about your interview, you know, I really liked how he challenged that boardroom trend of using AI just to downsize staff. You know, rather than measure AI's success by how many jobs can be cut, you know, he argues that the focus should be on pure per employee revenue growth and per employee profit growth. And, you know, in most corporate conversations, AI is treated like a bottom line tool. But I think, you know, as Tim pointed out, you know, he really argues it should be treated as a top of line tool. I really love this philosophy. You know, true operational efficiency, you know, isn't just about using AI to shrink the workforce, but rather empowering the existing workforce to drive that exponential revenue growth per employee.
Chime in on that. It's something that we were discussing. I've actually read this a lot when it comes to marketing in AI marketing. This has actually been a big trend. Like, it's not about replacing, it's more still adding that efficiency and making that be your co-partner. And it's, you still need that human touch, especially when it comes to marketing and AI marketing. You still need that human touch, and you still need that, you know, but it's going to help you deliver better results because it'll be your partner, not take away from the jobs, which is, I think it's great that it's being across industries. We have the same sentimentality.
Yeah, you know, Tim was, when we were talking, he basically summed it up in two words. I don't know if it's two words or one words, but he, in his most Germanic sense, he said, this whole thing about AI taking jobs is BS. So anyways, we'll leave it at that, I guess. All right. Up next, Vicky has the 2-Minute Tech Pulse.
So this week's 2-Minute Tech Pulse starts with some breakthrough in neuroscience. No, it's not an episode of Grey's Anatomy, but Meta AI just dropped this Brain 2 QWERTY version 2. What it basically does, it translates human thoughts into full text without requiring any surgical neural implant, like a neural link. Basically, volunteers wear external scanner that reads your tiny magnetic brain signals while they think and think about typing. So it's not even where you're thinking about typing, and that's how it basically collects the data. And it's still very, you know, at the beginning, it's a research lab tool, but it's really big because it's great for, you know, giving a voice to people who can't speak. So that's really cool. Next on the list, Anthropic release Claude Sonnet 5. They basically bypassed the minor version drop and just launched Claude Sonnet 5 globally. It's one of their most agentic models yet. It's meant to basically run completely unattended and delivers a high level of intelligence. And they come standard, all the features come standard in their pricing. Last, this is a really great tool, which not as many people know about or talk about as much as I love this. It is a design tool. It's Figma Motion. Basically, they added a functionality where it gives added native animation, and basically you can drop keyframes by talking about it, like make this chart grow with a playful bounce, and the AI will go ahead and automatically add that in. And you can then go ahead and give the CSS code directly to your developers, and it's a one-stop shop. So that's your pulse, your tech pulse this week.
I have two thoughts on that one. First, I like the idea that you can help people who are disabled. My sister's had a brain injury for the last 30 years. I think Susan knows this. And I wish at times that that type of technology was accessible to her. I know I have a lot more, I've seen a lot more research on it. And actually, I know they have a lot more research to do before the technology is viable. In any event, my second is that there's the idea that it's a few steps away. And yeah, I kind of repeat what you're saying. Susan, it's a couple steps away from being able to read your mind. That's scary. And what if you can eventually use these devices to control people? You know, we've all seen that movie, right? It's a trilogy and it doesn't end well. So that's it.
I do think it's, you know, I watch way too many medical shows, but not only that, but I also watch a little bit of too much Discovery. You know, thinking of locked-in syndrome, like that would be my biggest fear. And I think that is something that maybe this could be a way to help people with locked-in syndrome and any neurological things that are happening. And I wonder, thinking on a larger scale, how this could impact people with dementia or Alzheimer's, like things like that. So it'll be cool and interesting to see how this, you know, grows. It's a little bit interesting that it's coming from Meta, but, you know, hey.
It's got to come from somewhere.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, again, all kidding aside, worried about, you know, my thoughts being read when I don't want them to be. I think that kind of plays into our AI is scary, right? And we always go to the worst first, but it does seem like this is a technology that could really help a lot of people. So I'm excited to see it advance and get beyond that, those early stages.
I wonder if they'll ever test it on dogs, you know, like where find out what dogs are actually thinking about us.
Sign us up right now, because I'm pretty sure my dog would be telling me off in 1,000 different ways in different languages, because she's bilingual. I've confirmed it. Both of my dogs are bilingual, English and Spanish. But the judgment looks alone, I can only imagine what they're thinking. Right? I'm like, we're good. I don't need you to talk to me.
Yeah. Exactly. Maybe it's best if you don't know. But anyway, well, that's our show for today. Thanks for tuning in. If you like this podcast, please give it a like or share it with your friends and colleagues. You know, you can follow us on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please don't forget to subscribe to AI Impact Smart Brief. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
The Mostly AI podcast is a production of Smart Brief, a future company.